Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, for decades, the fight has gone on against commercial logging in the Shawnee National Forest. We'll get the latest as the federal government has moved to allow logging at the Southern Illinois site. We'll also hear from a student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, but he's not your typical student. He spent time in prison and now wants to help others who are incarcerated get their education. A church is being demolished to make way for student housing. It's symbolic of a trend we're seeing in religion. More on that. With the country seeming to be so divided, we'll bring together strangers to talk with one another. What they have to say is ahead. And we'll visit a museum that's closing. It was devoted to hair. Those stories and more are on the way on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Trump administration is using a legal shortcut to make it easier to cut down trees in national forests. Illinois' Shawnee National Forest, the state's only one, is an early battleground against the increasingly popular tactic to fast-track timber sales across the country. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco traveled to southern Illinois to bring us this story.
On a brisk November morning, Sam Stearns and I were trekking through the Shawnee National Forest.
See the down trees up there?
When he stopped suddenly under the cover of several pines about 60 feet tall.
We're going to see a whole lot more.
Stearns, a longtime opponent of logging, pointed to a tree that had been cut down and left on a steep hillside.
I mean, look, man, this is a nice, solid, straight, healthy red oak. I can tell by the bark, you know, that's a red oak, man.
The U.S. Forest Service manages over 190 million acres of public forest across the country. They approved this logging project in the Shawnee back in late 2024. They said the approximately 70-acre timber auction was a thinning operation. That means they'd remove older trees to make room for younger saplings to promote the health of the forest. Stearns believes the forest can take care of itself. He says trees are essential habitat for imperiled species, prevent erosion, and capture and store planet-warming carbon dioxide. No thinning needed.
That is damaging to the forest itself, to the water, the soil. But in terms of climate change, it's a loser from start to finish.
Stearns and other advocates plan to oppose the timber sale. So for months, they scoured through the web and local papers for any mention of the project. They almost missed it.
They named it V-Plow. That's V-Plow, which nobody knew, you know, to made any connection between that and this land here.
Before they connected the dots, the Forest Service was already a week into a three-week public comment period, according to John Wallace. He's another longtime advocate who opposes logging in the Shawnee National Forest. He added that the Forest Service was able to limit public input by using a legal loophole called a categorical exclusion.
Categorical exclusions are an exception to the National Environmental Policy Act's regulations of doing more rigorous environmental impact statements.
So in the Shawnee National Forest, using this loophole meant the Forest Service could bypass the usual environmental reviews and limit public participation in this process. That meant the only option left to opponents was to challenge the logging in court. Last summer, Stearns and other advocates did just that. They sued the Forest Service to stop the loggers. The case is still ongoing.
Since the beginning of the year, the administration has tried to put in place a number of new procedures to fast-track logging projects and has pushed hard on the agency to aggressively use categorical exclusions, among other things, to put out logging projects.
That's Garrett Rose, a senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Among the Trump administration's priorities, Rose says, is to supercharge logging. Trump issued an executive order calling on the Forest Service to increase U.S. timber production.
It's happening across the country.
The Forest Service recently used the legal loopholes to push through logging in Oregon's Mount Hood National Forest and in Alaska's Tongass National Forest. That's the largest national forest in the country. Back in southern Illinois, looking out at all the empty land. Stern says the Forest Service is especially good at one thing, cutting down trees.
Even if they were getting a premium price for this wood, which I know they're not, those trees would be much more valuable standing, contributing to the health of an ecosystem, than they'll ever be cut like that.
A Kentucky logging crew harvested about 40 acres of trees in late August, before temporarily halting in early September due to Stern's lawsuit. The loggers have yet to finish the job. Stern's hopes that they never do. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
A Pulitzer Prize-winning writer's new book examines the damage humans have done to the land and waters of rural Iowa. But despite the damage, he believes it's not too late to reverse course. Rich Egger has more.
Art Cullen is co-owner and editor of the Storm Lake Times in northwest Iowa. He earned a Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for a series of editorials about agricultural surface water pollution in the state. He continues to write about environmental destruction in his new collection of essays called Dear Marty, We Crapped in Our Nest, Notes from the Edge of the World. The book is published by Ice Cube Press. Cullen says we need to take stock of how we're depleting our natural resources. He says we're drinking aquifers dry and allowing soil to erode down the Mississippi River.
What used to be feet deep of black soil is now inches deep.
He says that soil and the agrochemicals in it are ending up in the Gulf of Mexico, which he says could be renamed the Gulf of Nitrates. But Cullen believes all is not lost. Cullen says rural communities and agriculture can be prosperous by changing their approach to the landscape from one of domination to one of living within what the land will allow.
That's what the native people did before the Europeans showed up with their idea of manifest destiny. We need to learn from the native people that live sustainably and lived very abundant lives. We need to learn from how they approach the landscape. They consider themselves to be in community with the land.
He says we know how to save soil, do minimum tillage, and plant cover crops. It's just a matter of will. And he believes the will is there as people realize what they're losing. Cullen is currently working on a series of short web videos, documentaries about the issues facing rural Iowa, which he says are water quality, cancer, agriculture, and rural consolidation.
They all point to each other. Water is implicated in cancer, which is implicated in agriculture, which is implicated in consolidation. I mean, it's all interrelated, all these issues.
He says those issues are causing a drain on rural America. The video project brought him to Keokuk recently. He says the town is an example of what happens after 50 years of rural consolidation. He says about 40% of the buildings on the city's main street are vacant.
It's amazing to me how people of Keokuk are determined to make their community successful. Despite getting no help from Des Moines, they get flown over and ignored.
Cullen says that lack of help from the state makes it difficult for communities such as Keokuk, Fort Madison, and Burlington to recover from setbacks such as plant closures. He says CNH's recent announcement that it will close its plant in Burlington is a huge loss to the region. Cullen's hometown, Storm Lake, has two Tyson meatpacking plants. He'd like to see corporations such as Tyson care more about the communities where they have plants. He also believes communities could benefit by attracting immigrants, especially young people who are starting families.
No matter what the slanders against them are, that they're criminals and drug runners and everything else, they're putting food on your table.
In the mid-1970s, Iowa's Republican Governor Rob Ray welcomed refugees from Southeast Asia. Cullen thinks Iowa now suffers from a hostile attitude toward immigrants. He blames that attitude on politicians, including Governor Kim Reynolds and former Congressman Steve King. Cullen would like to see candidates address issues such as water quality and cancer rates as they campaign in the coming year. But he's worried some will be timid about upsetting what he calls the agrochemical apple cart.
Everybody's on that money train, and they're all afraid of the Farm Bureau.
He hopes candidates are willing to address the hard truth because he says the hard truth is what's needed right now. Rich Ugger reporting.
Member station WBEZ produces a segment called Curious City, where listeners ask questions and reporters track down details. Aaron Allen brings us this edition that heads out to the library.
I'm Aaron Allen. The Chicago Public Library is over 150 years old, which means that some of the books in these branches are basically antiques. Last year, a bibliophile in Chicago stumbled upon a title that was well-worn, and it had that old book smell. This made him curious. How long can a CPL book live on the shelves? I'll let WBEZ's Stephen Arroyo take it from here.
Curious citizen Bradford Kasberg recently picked up a copy of Catherine Ann Porter's short story collection, Pale Horse, Pale Rider, from his beloved local Chicago Public Library, Sulzer Regional, in Lincoln Square.
And you could really tell that it was printed in the 60s. The binding, the yellowed pages made it look old, yeah. Everything about it. And my first thought when I grabbed it was, am I allowed to take this out of the library?
The worn binding, the brittle pages, they made Bradford curious. What is the oldest book in circulation within the Chicago Public Library system? So he put the question to the Ask a Librarian form on the CPL website and got a pretty quick response.
Hi, Bradford. I think the oldest book in circulation is called Life of James Crichton of Cluny. You can see it here in our catalog. It's from 1819. They added, I think that's a great Curious City question. If you ask them, maybe they'll find something even older.
Challenge accepted, Ask a Librarian. The Life of James Crichton of Cluny is an obscure title published in 1819 in Scotland. It's basically a biography of a Scottish polymath who perished under strange circumstances at age 21. I had to see if this book is, in fact, the oldest in circulation. So I headed to Harold Washington Library, and on the sixth floor, next to a memoir by Charlie Chaplin's son, was a hardcover book that I had no doubt was over 200 years old. I took it to the counter and was mildly shocked when they scanned the barcode and simply told me it was due back in 3 weeks. With an ancient secret in my backpack, I met up with Bradford at Sulzer Library. He had his doubts that you could even check this book out.
Are you serious?
This is it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
The edges of the pages are orange, kind of like a discolored orangish red. And the book binding itself is like a dark blue, slightly speckled, but overall in very good condition. It looks much newer than something I would have expected something from the late 1800s to look like.
The Life of James Crichton of Cluny was easy to check out, but confirming it was the oldest in circulation proved to be a bit more challenging. Sure, I could look in the library catalog and search by original publication date, but books are often reprinted, and that information in the system can be spotty. I reached out to all 81 Chicago Public Library locations, and while I got a couple leads, I never did confirm an older book. So it seems Ask a Librarian was right. But how does such a book outlast the thousands of other titles on the shelves? Lindsay Laren with the Chicago Public Library suspects James Crichton flew under the radar just enough. It starts with what librarians call the book weeding process, to make space for books that are newer or more relevant to the community.
And we have 81 branches, and so each branch and each neighborhood has its own specific needs. And so weeding at CPL actually happens at the branch level.
She says book weeding can occasionally be controversial, especially when not done regularly. Sometimes weeding has been mistaken for censorship. The topic of weeding has even played a part in the recent discourse around book banning. Lindsay says CPL never throws books away. we did books go to a vendor for resale, and that money comes back to the library. And if they're too damaged for reuse, they're recycled. As for the life of Crichton, Lindsay checked in with the Archives and Special Collections Division.
And they're like, you know, it doesn't look like this is something we would necessarily just add because it was old or even rare. I'm not sure it's technically rare. It is kind of a mystery to me. But, you know, if it's been checked out enough, if it's in fairly good condition, it just might not show up on anybody's lists or reports to look at for weeding. That's what I'm assuming happened, is that it just got kind of checked out enough.
In 1871, after the Great Chicago Fire, Queen Victoria donated a collection of books that became the bedrock of the Chicago Public Library's collection. Life of Crichton wasn't part of that, but there's a stamp inside the cover from 1892, which would mean that it entered the CPL collection just after the Queen's donation. So, all signs point to Life of Crichton being the oldest circulating CPL book, but how did the Ask a Librarian figure it out so quickly? Who is that person?
My name is Nick. I am a librarian at the Info Center at the Harold Washington Library Center in Chicago.
Nick is a real person, not a robot or some AI program. He was the Ask a Librarian who answered Bradford's original question. Nick went through date ranges, pulled some books, and through a process of elimination, he found Crichton.
It was kind of funny because, as far as I can tell, it's just kind of this weird book.
He says it's basically a self-published book, and it's not really worth anything.
Which is kind of good because when I found it, I was worried, there's going to be this valuable book in the collection that someone, if they find out about it, they're just going to steal it. So it's kind of this perfect storm of, the oldest book in our collection that we can find isn't really that special.
He's right. I read through the book, and it's just okay. If you want to see the oldest book in circulation, The Life of James Crichton of Cluny is available for hold at Harold Washington Library.
Thank you to WBEZ engagement producer Stephen Arroyo for reporting this story last year. As of this recording, The Life of James Crichton of Cluny is still in circulation. It's currently checked out, but you know, you can always get in line.
Thanks to member station WBEZ for that segment. There is more ahead on Statewide. We'll return in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The spring semester is underway at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and one student is really happy to be back. Mike Pierce is completing his master's degree in curriculum and instruction, and he plans to get his PhD. He's also formerly incarcerated. Pierce took college classes at the U of I through the school's Education Justice Project. Last year, he became the first from that program to get accepted into the U of I and come to classes on campus. Emily Hayes spoke with Pierce to ask why education is so precious to him and how he plans to improve access for other people in prison.
All University of Illinois students worked hard to get in, but you have overcome some unique obstacles. What does starting the spring semester mean to you?
Education has been life-changing for me. And I support and I am very mission driven towards furthering my own education and that of others because of it. I always tell people that many of the issues of my past, my wandering youth especially, comes from a space where I felt I could not communicate with the world and I couldn't understand it either. So there was an inability to communicate. And when that happens, then you find yourself warring with that which you don't understand. Education has allowed me to both understand the world and make myself understood. And that changes the way you can interact with it.
Can you tell me a little bit about what are some things that, if they were different in your community that you grew up in, would have changed your trajectory?
Well, I like to tell people that I grew up poor. I don't have an accurate judgment of poverty because what I thought was poor seems to be abject poverty and not just poor. I think that if there had been more community support, especially mental health, then there would have been a different trajectory to my life. A lot of the drug use that I participated in as a kid had to do with self-medication.
Do you mind telling me kind of like where you grew up so people have a, a sense of where in Illinois?
Yeah, so Southern Illinois, little town called Walnut Hill, which is like 10, 20 miles away from the largest town. So you're looking at a community of like 50 people. The next community over is 500 people. And where I grew up, there was actually like dirt roads, cornfields, soybean fields. And so some of my neighbors literally lived in like shacks that had tin as the walls and stuff. So I grew up hunting, a little bit of farming, a little bit of support from the community. So the idea of like food banks and stuff like that. But my mother worked at Walmart and supported a family of six off like 13,000 a year at that time. So it was not a great life coming up. And looking back, my siblings and I talk about what we had thought was normal and how hard life was, and our desires to not have our kids and future generations have it the same way.
You are working on a master's degree in curriculum and instruction and going on to a PhD in the same subject. What do you hope to do with your degrees?
It has been my goal since before I came to Peoria and got into a master's degree program to get a degree that would help me create a higher education program for prison settings, in particular, a graduate degree program. So I've been in college for 18 years. I have 240-ish college credits, but for the longest time, I couldn't take anything but an associate degree level course. And then when I got my associates, I was immediately kind of kicked out of college because I'd gone as far as I could at that point. And I couldn't take another college class for 7 or 8 years until I relocated to Danville and I participated with the Education Justice Project, which was bringing undergrad level courses, but no degree. In 2022, I think, Eastern Illinois University brought an undergrad program to Danville Correctional Center. I was in the first cohort there, and I immediately started taking undergrad classes and doing what I needed to do to get my bachelor's. When we asked them about a graduate program, I was informed that it is very difficult to create one of those, especially for the difficulties that a prison setting brings to the classroom, and that there are certain requirements for creating one. You have to have someone who has a PhD in curriculum and instruction, and it takes, 3 or 4 years to develop that, even whenever you get started. So I said, okay.
Mr. Pierce, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been a pleasure.
Mike Pierce, formerly incarcerated, now a student at the U of I at Urbana-Champaign. He spoke with Emily Hayes. Like many American colleges and universities, Augustana College is changing its Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion while expanding on its long-held mission to improve campus diversity. Jonathan Turner has more on that story.
In response to the federal government's anti-DEI policies and orders, more than 400 colleges and universities have eliminated or rebranded programs and centers that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, including at the Rock Island Private Liberal Arts School. After 10 years of growth in strengthening campus connection and building students' intercultural skills, Augustana will evolve its DEI office into the Office of the Vice President for Culture and Connection beginning this year. With Vice President Gauri Patale and Ashley Allen, Executive Director for Intercultural Experiences, Augie President Andrea Talentino on Wednesday spoke about how the national DEI conversation led the college to make the changes.
There's no question that that pushed us to think about what we were doing and to really look carefully at the programs we had. The other piece that was really essential to it is that we did start our diversity equity programs 10 years ago, and we really try, like a good institution, to make sure that we review things kind of on a standard basis. So 10 years is generally kind of a standard review. So between those two things, we started really looking at where we were and said, you know what? There are things that we can do better, and there are ways that we need to change.
This is Jonathan Turner.
Another effort is being made to rein in credit card swipe fees. Many small businesses say the costs are making it difficult on them. When you pay with a credit card, a percentage of the purchase is taken off what the business receives. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin has sponsored legislation for years to lessen the bite card companies can charge. Cindy Forsina, owner of Legendary Small Town Trading Company in Taylorville, says the amount she pays in fees is nearing her monthly utility costs.
It puts a small business owner like myself in a really tough position. Do you pass those costs on to the consumer? Or do you absorb them yourself and it already cuts into razor-thin margins?
Forsina says many consumers prefer to charge what they buy but may not realize the impact. The legislation would target what some call a near monopoly. It would require large banks to add more competition, including a non-MasterCard or Visa network, and give business owners an option. Senator Durbin says President Trump has signaled he supports the effort. Every year, Illinois students vote on the Reader's Choice Awards for the books they love the most. Peter Medlin spoke with an English teacher and award chair, Nicole Folkman, about the books that won in 2025.
Kindergarten through third grade is the Monarch Award, and this year the winner was There's a Ghost in This House by Oliver Jeffers. This is not, I imagine, your typical haunted house. This is spooky, but also fun and like interactive, right?
Yes. So for kids, it's really fun because it's the kind of book where they're in on the joke, but the main character is not. And they absolutely adore that. It also has this beautiful thing going on with the art where it's like vellum pages that turn. You can't see the ghost, just like the main character can't. And then you turn the page and we see the ghost. And so they love being able to like guess and imagine where the ghost is going to show up on the page. I read that with my high school students on Halloween this year, and they enjoyed it as well. We had a lot of fun.
And very cool with that, where you kind of get to control the pacing, so you're not, you know, you control the jump scare to a degree, right?
Absolutely. And they're very cute ghosts.
Yes. So. And then the Blue STEM Award is chosen by students in third through fifth grade. What won the Blue STEM this year?
Otter by Catherine Applegate and Charles Santoso. Catherine Applegate is the author and Charles Santoso does the beautiful pencil sketches throughout the book. This is a novel in verse, which the students absolutely love. It's soft and gentle and beautiful and still teaches them about the environment and how scientists learn how to best help animals.
Also with that, we do have the Rebecca Caudle Award. Can you tell us a little bit about Rebecca Caudle really quick?
Yeah, so the Rebecca Caudle Award is kind of a 4th through 8th. The winner of the Rebecca Caudle this past year was The Inheritance Games by Jennifer Lynn Barnes.
The Inheritance Games is also the first in a series of YA novels. And this is something that, again, maybe I'm not reading as many YA novels as I did when I was a YA, you know. But
oh,
like,
you're missing out. They're amazing.
I really am. But I thought it was fascinating because it felt my perception was, especially the last 15, 20 years, a lot of those big YA series were very post-apocalyptic, very Hunger Games, Maze Runner, and this is not that.
No, this is much more a realistic fantasy dream world. So Avery Grahams is the random inheritor of billions of dollars from some guy she's never met and never even really heard of. And she, in inheriting the money, has disinherited all of the kids and grandkids. And it is like this wish fulfillment of what kid wouldn't want to go, oh, wait, I have more money than I can literally even spend. But there is a catch. She has to live in the house with all the disinherited family for 1 year in order to get the money. And there are puzzles and games and intrigue and drama. And it is one of my personal favorite series.
So the last up on the list, we'll finish off with the Lincoln Award, which is the Teen Readers Award. And this one, I was fascinated by what won. This one, I'm Glad My Mom Died by Jeanette McCurdy, which I remember was a huge deal when it came out a few years ago. Jeanette McCurdy, of course, was a huge star on Nickelodeon when I was a kid. And this is, again, her memoir about her relationship with her abusive mother. It's got a very, obviously, provocative title and book cover, if you've seen that one, too. But, I mean, what do you make about this one winning the award this year?
It's been really interesting to me. Last year on that list and the new 2026 list both have a decent amount of adult crossover titles. So I'm Glad My Mom Died is written and marketed for adults, but it has really wonderful teen crossover appeal and is perfectly appropriate for teens as well. And they have really enjoyed it. They didn't grow up as Nickelodeon kids, like at least in the right time period for this.
Right, yeah.
But they are drawn in, like you said, by that cover, by that title. And then you start to tell them a little bit about the story and they're like, oh my gosh. And they read it and they can't put it down. Once I saw the list and started reading the books, I wasn't surprised that that one won in the end.
Nicole Folkman is chair of the Reader's Choice Awards. She spoke with Peter Medland about the books Illinois students loved the most in 2025. Find a full list. We have a link at our show page. A lock of hair can be a lasting remembrance of a person who died, and in Independence, Missouri, hair became much more than that. For nearly 40 years, Leila's Hair Museum featured wreaths, jewelry, and other artifacts made from human hair. The museum closed last year and is finding new homes for the hairy artistry. Julie Denishe reports.
From a small storefront on a busy street in Independence, Missouri, Lindsay Evans is on a mission. Since February, she's been in contact with museums across the country to find new homes for her grandmother's most treasured artifacts.
My grandmother always said there were one of two reactions when people came in the museum. And the first one was, oh my gosh, this is hair? Wow. The other was, this is hair? Oh my gosh. And they would kind of run the other way.
The 3,000-piece collection includes Victorian-era jewelry and around 1,000 delicately crafted wreaths, all made from human hair.
Some people have a little bit of an ick factor with it. It is an odd collection.
Evan says her grandmother, Leila Cahoon, who founded the museum in 1986, died last fall, and the museum closed in September. So for almost four decades, Leila's Hair Museum was what Cahoon called the world's largest collection of hair work.
They're absolutely gorgeous. From far away, you look at them and you just think, wow, that's a beautiful piece of art. And then you get close and realize that's hair. It's absolutely incredible.
Elaborate Victorian-era wreaths encased in shadow box frames once covered the walls. Creating them took months or even years to complete. Each tells a story, like the one of sisters in Sedalia, Missouri, who created a wreath when they entered a convent. A teacher in Maine crafted another from her students' hair. One wall was devoted to hair from icons like Elvis Presley, John F. Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, and Michael Jackson.
Packed safely away, ready to go.
Yes.
I love it. Okay.
Sarah Bader King stopped by to choose a few wreaths with local connections. She's curator at two of Kansas City's most historic structures, the John Warnell and Alexander Majors House Museums.
It just seemed like the perfect opportunity to, you know, help her keep things in Kansas City while also adding to our collection in a really substantial way.
It might work.
As word got out that the museum was closing, a flurry of visitors have come for tours. Karen Bachman is a professor of the history of jewelry at New York's Pratt Institute.
These things got shoved in attics and forgotten about. People would look and go, I don't even know whose hair that is. But when you appreciate it and you see it in a collection such as this, they're still remembered. They're still valued.
Listening to you talk, I feel like my grandmother's here again because the things that you're saying are the things that she would tell people about these pieces. And so I love having people here who know and appreciate this art form as much as she did.
As Evans begins to wrap up the months-long process, she says she's grateful to share her grandmother's passion.
That's what she wanted for me, and it's helping me grieve in a way I didn't even realize I needed. And so I've loved that.
Evans said her grandmother wrote in a letter that she wanted her to share Leila's Hair Museum. Now she's hoping others around the country can learn more and appreciate the unusual artifacts that will now be located elsewhere. For NPR News, I'm Julie Deneche in Kansas City.
We'll be back with more of Statewide in a moment. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An historic church building in Champaign has been demolished to make way for more student housing. What's happened to the University Place Christian Church is part of a national trend driven by the shifting demographics of religion. Anna Koh has more.
On a Sunday in mid-September, under the dark wood ceiling at Unit Place Christian Church, sunlight streams through the stained glass windows. The pews are packed for the final worship service held inside this neo-Gothic building. Like many here, Kay Mahana grew up in the church.
My husband and I married here 14 years ago in this sanctuary, and he has since passed. So this holds a very special place in my heart.
Attendance at Sunday morning services at Unit Place has been dropping since the 1950s. The sanctuary at Wright in Springfield was built in 1934 to accommodate 600 worshipers. By this past summer, 50 or so might show up. Mahana says the congregation has been fighting a losing battle to maintain the aging structure.
I've been a part of all the cleanups when there was water. We've known that the pipes had corroded badly and were behind the walls, and the walls had asbestos in them.
Eric Freifogel chairs the church's board of trustees. At some point over the years, he and other church members gave the building a nickname, Bob, the big old building.
Whenever something goes wrong, we say, Bob is calling out again. When our basement is flooded and people have to rush in here and to try to deal with the mess, for example, Bob is calling, you know, or electricity goes out, we got plaster falling off the wall, Bob is calling.
Freifogel says the cost of maintaining Bob, the church building, was threatening the long-term viability of the church itself, the community of believers.
It is whether the wrecking ball is going to hit the church building or whether it's going to hit the congregation.
Last March, the church trustees voted unanimously to sell the building. Fairlawn Realty had offered to buy it at the appraised value of $4.1 million. The kind of money that could sustain a congregation for years.
You know, many, many churches have been demolished or repurposed.
That's David Alboy, a professor of economics at the University of Illinois.
The church doesn't play as central a role in our lives as it used to.
He says older urban churches like Unit Place are finding it more and more difficult to maintain their buildings. Leslie Baker, who now lives near Detroit, grew up in University Place Christian Church.
I attended services, Sunday school, youth group at the church. I was baptized there. I was married there in 1982, and my sons were baptized there.
In May, Baker learned that the church had decided to sell the property. She filed an application asking the city's Historic Preservation Commission to nominate the building as a landmark. To get a building designated as a landmark in Champaign, it has to be approved at three levels. First, the Historic Preservation Commission looks at whether it has historical or architectural significance. Then, a separate commission weighs in at a public hearing. But it's ultimately up to the City Council to make the final call. If the City Council approves a landmark nomination, then any plans to sell or demolish the building can be stopped. Baker says she wasn't doing all this work just for herself.
I'm doing this for my grandparents, my parents, and for all of the generations of University Place Christian Church members and community members who worked and sacrificed over the decades to build this beautiful church from the ground up.
In the end, Baker's application to preserve the building made it to the City Council, which ultimately denied the request, taking into account the rising maintenance costs and the fact that the contract to sell the building was already in place. The church's deal with Fairlawn closed at the end of October, and the building was demolished. Fairlawn has submitted plans to develop the site into a five-story, 283-unit apartment building called the Mosaic. For the foreseeable future, University Place Christian Church will meet in the University YMCA. Freifogel says that many of the architectural items that made a church at Wright in Springfield so special have been preserved. For example, some of the stained glass windows were removed for demolition.
We intend to break up into pieces and do hand them out as mementos to church members.
He says these pieces of stained glass are akin to a photo on the wall of a beloved ancestor deeply missed, a reminder of the continuity among generations. The pipe organ has also been removed and rehomed to a church in Jackson, Missouri. All of that is cold comfort for Leslie Baker.
So I guess I just assumed that my, you know, future funeral would be at University Place Christian Church. So that was just kind of a hard realization that mine and many other people's, you know, may not have that choice in the future because of what's happening with this church.
Amanda Koh, IPM News.
This past year, Tri-State's Public Radio collaborated with StoryCorps to participate in One Small Step. That's a project that pairs strangers with different beliefs to have a conversation and remind us of our common humanity. Meet Bryce and Tanya as they talk about vulnerability, blended families, and how labels can get in the way of understanding.
What made you want to have this conversation today?
I thought it was a really good way for people to come together and talk, particularly if they see themselves as having divergent points of view, because I think that the climate that we're in right now has made it really hard for people to talk to each other. There's a lot of talking at each other.
I have not done something like this before, and I think things like this are great because more even students or young adults should be doing more face-to-face conversations and, like you said, hearing people and not talking at them or through them.
I think it's very easy to get guarded. You're worried about that vulnerability.
Yes. Vulnerability is a very, very big term that a lot of, especially young adults like myself, have right now, because a lot of young adults feel vulnerable and scared to have those face-to-face interactions, even within the public, with phone calls, with interviews, and it's you don't want to let your guard down because you're scared people are going to walk all over you. And I think that's something that my generation struggles with from time to time. Though with college institutions, I think there are multiple organizations within universities that help build that confidence. I'm a part of the Alpha Gamma Rho fraternity as an ag student at Western, and I'm also part of the Agvocators recruiting team. And through these experiences that I have, I have built my confidence and built that professionalism that is needed when entering the workforce post-undergrad. So,
I've heard good things about Alpha Gamma Rho.
Oh, thank you.
Because you guys engage in a lot of service, from what I understand,
yes,
in the community.
Mm-hmm. So. Tell me about your life growing up.
I grew up in rural West Virginia
in
a coal mining community.
That's awesome.
And so father died when I was quite young, and my mother remarried, so I grew up in a blended family. Mm-hmm. So I have an older brother and an older stepbrother, and they're just a few months apart in age. That was fun. When that family came together, that was fun. My stepfather was a coal miner, and my mom stayed at home for a while, then went back and got her... Well, she first got her GED, and then because she dropped out of school to get married when she was 15, actually. Well. And then, so she went back and went to beauty school. So she was a beautician.
That's awesome.
A cosmetologist. So, you know, I grew up in a rural area surrounded by mountains, this really beautiful region
amazing.
Of the state. You know, also had some economic ups and downs, but that was what my household was. There were the five of us.
That's awesome.
How about you?
My household, I grew up in Morton, Illinois. My parents separated when I was 6 or 7 months old. So, and then my dad remarried, my mom remarried. I have, my stepdad had 3 kids of his own at the time. So I have 2 older stepsisters, an older stepbrother. They had a kid, my mom and stepdad had a kid. That's my younger brother, Cole. And then with my dad, he had remarried, and him and his wife had a daughter. That's my little half-sister, Vida. And then they unfortunately split, and my dad is now remarried to a Candace. She is wonderful. She used to be a cosmetologist herself. She's a cosmetologist for 20 years. And my family and I, more on my mom and stepdad's side, were very religious. I wouldn't say like very, very, but we are religious people. We are Christians. I think the values that we take from that and put it into our family, we've experienced a lot of loss, and knowing that through that loss has brought us closer together than ever.
I think that we have so much more in common as just human beings who live life and go through struggles every day than we tend to see or recognize. I think we focus a lot on labels. You know, this is my list of labels, mm-hmm. and these are the things that I do. And there's a whole set of like assumptions about who a person is that are based on that, you know. And I think if we can get past that and really kind of see the person in every, you know, like every person is their own individual.
Mm-hmm. That's Tanya and Bryce, two people who agreed to a collaboration with StoryCorps, bringing people with different beliefs together. Here are Will and Jennifer. She's a rabbi. Will lost his wife a few months ago. He begins by telling us how, as a young man, he entered the seminary.
I dropped out, but then my brother, who was 7 years younger than me, decided to try. He lasted 3 years. But the first year he was there, the president of the student council and the valedictorian and the captain of the bowling team was Bob Prevost, who today is Pope Leo XIV.
Uh-huh.
Had I gone to Peru, I would have been his superior down there. I would have been telling him what to do.
Wow.
Yeah. So, okay, and just to kind of finish up on the faith thing, when I got married the first, I had a, you know, starter marriage. Mm-hmm. I was 19, did not work out. But then I met, you know, my wife of 37 years, Luz, and she was pretty Catholic. The family was more Catholic than she was, but mm-hmm. But I gave it another try, you know. I went to Mass all through Lent. I mm-hmm. really tried. I just couldn't make it stick. I just couldn't. I tried again. We decided we wouldn't raise our kids, you know, wouldn't send them to Catholic school, but we want to give them, you know, you have to have like an ethical base.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Well, I think it's, in addition to being a rabbi, I'm a chaplain at St. Mary's Hospital here in Galesburg, so... Mm-hmm. At a good Catholic institution,
right.
I see so many patients who really struggle with theodicy, right? Like, if there's a loving God, why do bad things happen to good people? Mm-hmm. You know, and to my mind, there's not a great answer. You know, I can't be like, well, you know, this is either divine punishment or, you know, no, I'm not going to tell anybody that, you know, or...
The devil made me do it.
The devil made you do it, or your reward will come later, or I'm not...
Yeah.
We don't know, you know. But how to grapple with those things, you know, and have faith is a lifelong process, you know. I'm not going to try to convert you, just like I don't try to convert any patients I see. But sometimes I do sort of point them toward, you know, both of our faith traditions, right? There's a reason we have the Book of Job, mm-hmm. you know, who's this really nice, upstanding guy who every horrible thing befalls him, mm-hmm. right? It's a study of what happens, you know, and I always like Ecclesiastes, right? Like, right, the sort of beginning of a futility, mm-hmm. all is futile, right? You know, sort of,
yeah.
We have these books in our tradition that say, yeah, it's bad sometimes, and we don't know why.
Well, to, you know, to really get right to it, and this
yeah.
is my daughter, and at the time, she's been in Galesburg, and she was in her own apartment, and now she's actually living with me, and she wants to get back to Chicago, but she's trying to save money, so she's with
mm-hmm.
me. The time she was living two doors down, renting, and she... She was telling me that Luz was visiting her in her dreams, in her sleep,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh, well, why not me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I have to admit, I wanted to believe that I was going to see her again.
Yeah.
That's
human.
Really,
that's
yeah,
so human.
Yeah, that's what motivated it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know... Maybe it'll happen. I'm certain, like I said, agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
who knows?
Yeah.
I don't understand everything about the world that I can see. There's certainly stuff that I can't see that I don't understand. You know? So maybe. But, you know, that's how that happened.
That's Will and Jennifer, two of the people who agreed to participate in One Small Step, a project pairing strangers with different beliefs together to have a conversation. Thanks to Tri-State's Public Radio for those segments. And you can find out more about the project at our statewide show page. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along, and join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Listen where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.